All right, I'm Stephanie.
And I'm Natalia.
And this is Till Death Do Us Part.
I definitely have things to talk about on the podcast.
Do you want to start?
Sure, I can start with some crazy stalker stories to gear up for Valentine's Day.
Ooh.
I have, I don't know, stories abounding for stalkers with the upcoming Day of Love. Yes.
Oh.
I'm trying to think of, I don't think I've ever had like a stalker, but me and my friend Terry and I had a crush on the same boy when we were like in middle school, and we stalked the shit out of this little kid, and we would chase him, and he would have to run to his mom's car like after school because he couldn't even like.
Wow.
So that's the last time I stalked someone per se.
You are a demon.
I am. Well, what, have you ever had a stalker or anything like that?
I did have that one guy who was following me when I walked the dog for those couple of weeks. But then I made the TikToks about him and he disappeared.
He was watching, which is a very stalkery thing to do.
Yes, but he's gone. That was the only one, though.
That's crazy.
That's it. Other than that, but I have got some real juicy ones, some real psycho shit. So I got to go into the courthouse and Ron was in the courthouse. I had the pleasure sit in on one of his cases.
Cool.
It was quite interesting. And there was a gentleman who was being sentenced because he was stalking a woman. He had stalked her. This was his, I want to say his second, if not his third time for stalking the same woman. So he had gone to jail previously already for stalking this woman, had come out on parole, and then continued to stalk her. But the real juicy part for me was the fact that he had the balls to stalk her, even though she was dating a sheriff.
Wow. Well, first of all, I want to know what's so great about this chick that she can get stalked twice and I can't even get one. That is very bold.
Right?
No shame.
None. I thought that was really just next level. Apparently, it all started because he would watch out his window. Young mother, small children. She was first married when he first was peeping in on her. He was her next door neighbor. He's like an older dude too. I'm talking about like early 60s. And would look out his window, peeping in on her. It really bothered him that she was married and was fooling around with a cop. And this went on for years. She divorced her husband. She then gets with the cop and he continues to stalk her. Just insanity.
He was doing it so long that he just couldn't stop it.
I mean, it's, I guess, a real compulsion. I mean, that's what a stalker is, right? They cannot stop themselves. It's an obsession that he had with just her. Every time got out of prison, he went right back to stalking her.
That's right? Kind of scary, because do stalkers always escalate or no?
I want to say that they, the majority of time, would, unless something stops them, like prison, or their victim, like she did, changes her name and moves away. So hopefully, the next time he gets out of prison, she has now changed her name. We don't know what it is. They only gave her initials moving forward in court. She is now known as whatever, XYZ, and she said she is moving. So hopefully, she has now moved so far away and changed her name that he will never find her. And I assume that is the only way they ever stop.
That's
scary.
Really scary. Yeah.
It is. It's bonkers. That's one.
That is scary. And I think that those harassing stalker complaints, when the police get them, they should be taken seriously. Because there's just something about stalkers, peeping Toms, people who are spying on other people. It just, for me, it really... I don't know. I can handle a lot of things, but that unknowing being stalked or harassed is really scary for some reason.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we've seen in enough cases, I think they take it much more seriously now, but I think that's because they saw enough cases where that went severely wrong in the 70s and 80s where they poo-pooed it, right? And said, oh, it's not a big deal.
Blah, blah, blah.
They saw where that went. So I think they take it more seriously now. I also think it can be difficult, though, depending on how the stalking is done. And if you catch them, getting restraining orders and getting yourself away from them, short of moving to another town and changing your name, can be difficult to shake these people or get the law to stop them. That's the first one. I mean, these people are mentally ill, mentally unstable. It is not a large step to see how it can go wrong really quickly.
Yeah.
So we recently went out on a double date with another couple who are friends of ours, and they were telling us a story. So there is two people who move in together after they've been together for 5 years. I think maybe they're engaged or getting engaged. They just bought a house together. And they're moving into the house. Literally, things are still in boxes, right? And it's one of their first nights in the house, and the doorbell rings. The girlfriend goes to the door, and standing at the door is a woman who tells her she is the boyfriend's side piece.
Oh,
hey, I'm the sneaky link. Here I am. Girlfriend says, get the hell away, shuts the door. Boyfriend says, that's nuts. Now, here it is. The sneaky link standing outside the door is his ex from a long time ago. He says, you know, this is a very long time ago. I don't know what she's talking about. Girlfriend says, fine. Next day, sneaky link shows up at her job. Okay, waits for her outside her job. When she comes out, sneaky link shows her her cell phone with pictures, not great pictures, kind of blurry pictures, and says, like, here you go. Here's my proof. I've been messing around with him. Now girlfriend's like, what the hell is going on? You need to stay away from me. Sneaky link is like, no, him and I are meant to be together. It's always been like that. He always comes back to me. You need to pay attention.
Gee.
Here's the thing. A couple of things. Girlfriend is gorgeous.
Okay.
Our dude is not so much. I don't want to say ugly, but he should be holding on to that with two hands and thanking the gods. Our girl Sneaky Link is definitely ugly.
Really?
I'm going to say that because she's also an ugly person, so I don't feel bad saying that. But she's nuts. What maybe our dude should have explained to girlfriend of 5 years is that this Sneaky Link, he's been having her stalk him and all his girlfriends for like a decade. Yeah, like she's been following him around and harassing him and whoever he's dated for a very long time. But he failed to mention that ever.
I thought for a second you were going to say like they really were together. That was his wife or I don't know.
They did date. So they did mess. They were messing around a long time ago. And
but you can't let him go.
You know, girlfriend's like, well, why didn't you ever get a restraining order? Why haven't you ever done anything about it? Oh, well, I feel bad for her.
What? Did he do something that he shouldn't have to her or something?
So here's this mess now. Sneaky Link is truly unhinged. Says that his dead mother and Tupac came down from heaven to tell her personally that they're meant to be together.
What? Yeah. What? Tupac's in heaven? Okay. Wow. That's cool, I guess.
Here's my thing. This guy is entertaining this bullshit for a long time. You don't do that if you love another woman, truly. That girlfriend needs to run as fast as she can in the other direction. That man is not for you. Because Sneaky Link, crazy, is going to do something and ruin your life and your peace of mind.
Something's going to happen.
Right? That's first of all. Second of all, something's wrong with how this man has handled his business here. Because whether it's for the ego stroke or because he feels guilty and did something, whatever it is that he entertained this, it's not okay. It's not okay that he didn't warn you. It's not okay that he didn't put a stop to it.
Very suspicious.
Right? Supposedly, he got a lot of messages from Sneaky Link. How did she get the address to the new house?
Yeah. Is he talking to her on the like?
Yeah, because he feels bad for her and thinks that, well, this is how I manage her. No, no, honey. That's bullshit.
He's just keeping it going.
Of course he is.
I feel bad for that woman.
Yeah, I feel bad for her too.
And the stalker too, because he's teasing her.
He is absolutely breadcrumbing her.
Yeah.
Right? At a certain point, he's going to either get sick of it because he's not actually ever going to be with her. He's not interested in that. And she's then going to get mad and she's going to decide to, you know, hurt him, hurt herself, hurt whoever he's with. You know, something, it's not going to end well. Bad on all sides.
Poor.
So, absolutely. So, but he is absolutely a big part of that problem. That is him leading that circus.
Wait, so they've been together like 5 years and she just started appearing as the stalker?
Yes. So I asked that. Did she ever get any inclination that something was going on? She knew that this was an ex-girlfriend and he had mentioned that she was, you know, like a little crazy about him and had tried to contact him. And there was some other times where she thought he wasn't where he was supposed to be. And like she drove to go see if he was some other little red flags, but nothing outright. But, you know, I feel like it's always that way.
Yeah.
I feel like it's almost never that you catch them. You know, it's not like Shaggy. You don't catch them in the shower. You don't catch them on the floor. It's always the little things. Before the big lead up, before the hand in the cookie jar, it's the little things that tip you off. It's the little mm-hmm. feelings, the little things. And then they explain it away, right? And you believe it until the girl's at your door.
That's the thing, is those hairs on the back of your neck, that feeling in your stomach or that little voice. That's so important to listen to. I mean, for
the
many reasons.
Bacteria.
You're not crazy. It's just,
wow.
How heartbreaking is that, though?
It is. These stalkers, they are everywhere. They are more prevalent than I thought. I've gotten a real handful of them in my face recently. I'm like, holy cow.
That's crazy. So stalkers out there, cover your tracks. Jesus. No, I'm just kidding. Do better.
Right? You know, everybody get gear up for Valentine's Day.
Yeah, you're welcome. So in the news, a story really shocked me. This lady, Sabrina Ray, she is in Des Moines, Iowa. Over the course of her career, I guess she had a daycare. She took care of 112 different children in 13 years. And among some of those children, she would foster. Basically, she was killing foster children, and it took over a decade for her to be found out, and she was doing it because she was getting child care subsidies, and I don't know how much it was. One thing I read was like over $600,000. The amount of abuse and murders and things that have been going on, I can't believe that this isn't like front page news.
That's insanity.
Insane. And it was just her crimes started in 2006 and went all the way to like 2018. And then they start, the earliest article I saw was from like 2020.
Wow.
You think nowadays, how can that go under the rug or be swept aside? And it still is happening. And it just, I don't know. It was really shocking to me.
I feel like that whole system is so jacked. I was just listening to a story on NPR. I feel like this ties right into it. They were saying that they're in the middle of a whole investigation because they found in the foster system, and I didn't know that they do this, that parents who have had to give up their children, that sometimes the parents will be told, well, you know, once you've completed your program, AA or anger management, or you've bought a big enough house or whatever it is that they need to do to like make their homes good enough for the children.
Yeah. So they can get their kids back.
Right. You can get your kids back. So they'll go to get their kids back and they will get a bill from the state to get their children back. These bills are like $17,000.
Really?
How do you? Yeah. And they won't be able to like do a payment plan. You'll have a single mom, three kids, 20,000 bucks a pop. These bills that are, you know, quote unquote, for, you know, what it cost to raise their children while they were in foster care, which I'm sorry, that's fucking bullshit. I know that was not what your children got spent on them while they were in these bullshit foster homes with parents like that woman, in these homes where they're abused and have shit clothes put on them and they have like holes in their shoes and fed like fucking oatmeal every day for dinner. Okay. And now this woman's getting bills for like tens of thousands of dollars, like a single mom like that working at a Denny's as a waitress. She is never going to get her kids back. But on top of let's just say that she could go and like get a loan or ask all her entire family to lend her the money. It doesn't matter because what they found, the real cincher here, they found that even when they would go to pay these bills, the state would be like, oh, well, sorry, but the other parents have already adopted the kid. The papers are already done.
Oh my God.
And when they went digging around a little more, they found that actually the papers for like these kids to be taken away had been finalized before the bills and everything had been sent out, or the notices warning these parents, oh, if you don't pay this bill, the kids will be given away. They had been sent out. Right. So basically, the parents didn't have a chance. They didn't get a warning. The kids had been taken away and those letters either never got sent out, or by the time the parents came and like asked about the kids, the kids were given away. The system worked against them to begin with.
God, that's so sad, because then in some cases, well, then where's the motivation to work and get your kid? Of course, you want every parent to like fight for your family, every parent to fight for their kids, you know, but if it's that hard, I mean, some parents have alcoholism and it's a disease. And if they do get better and show they can get better, then why can't they have their family?
Or I've seen too much of that system and how DIFAS works to take kids away. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the kids get taken away for such bullshit because some family care worker came into a house and just didn't like the mom. And they liked how the other parent's house looked better because the other parent was a charming narcissist and managed to charm the pants off the worker. Mm. Or they came in and they smelt weed in the house. And now they've taken all the kids away. God. Like real bullshit that they'll take kids away from parents. They interviewed one mom. This mom, she cleaned up her act literally in like 3 weeks and her two boys got taken away from her. They never knew. The kids were like 5 and 8. They never knew what had happened. She got all the money together. It didn't matter. The state took her kids away. She didn't get to see them till they were like grown up. They thought that their mom had given them away. Now, she sued the state and got money back. And she was saying like, I don't give a shit about the money. I lost their childhood. What good is the money now?
Yeah. I mean, she's still the mother.
Right. And even if these kids went to like a good foster home, but like imagine them going to a woman like this who's abusing and killing children. The state sends you a bill to the real parents.
Yeah. Audacity, you know,
the whole system rigged.
I will say there is a family that I follow on Instagram because I was shocked at the way that she makes breakfast. It's the Dirty Dozen Instagram. I don't know if you've ever seen them. They're like TikTok famous, but she fosters and has adopted 12 children. Some of them have some extra needs. And this family is so adorable. So there are good foster parents and families out there.
There are. You can't judge the whole barrel by one bad apple. I understand. My story actually talks about how the whole system can get ruined. It takes one person to ruin the party. I personally know a couple that couldn't have kids and they fostered. I mean, it's a white couple and they fostered minority children their entire lives. They did good work. There are good people out there who provide really good foster homes. Not all foster homes are bad foster homes.
Once in a blue moon, there's this lady in Des Moines, Iowa, who fucks it up for everyone.
Oh, my God. Yes. But I was also surprised that it's not bigger news. I mean, they're covering everything about the murdered college kids. But this lady just, why isn't this on the national headlines?
I mean, this is either just as important or more important because it went on longer. It wasn't just one night.
Mm-hmm. Just so many victims.
What makes those college kids in Idaho more special? Because they're like cheery and white?
Sensationalism. It's just, you know what? Sometimes we talk about this. When there are so many victims, we become desensitized. It's like too many faces. It sometimes becomes so horrific that it almost doesn't matter. It's sad. It becomes easier to sensationalize a few rather than many.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of money, I think it's so funny when we post an episode and then later on, I will find another podcast that I've been listening to has also covered the same story. So we did Belle Guinness and I sent you the podcast Tenfold More Wicked, where she interviews someone who wrote a book about Hell's Princess. And I didn't listen to this episode for so long because I was like, I don't know who Hell's Princess is. And it was Belle Guinness. So I sent you the episode because I was like, oh my God.
Oh my God. I love that. I love when I see something pop up like that. Once in a while, I'll come across something.
Yes. Yeah, so it was really interesting. They go into some of Belle's early life from Norway.
Cool.
And we definitely covered different things. So I would suggest listening to both episodes because they're, even though it's on the same topic, it's still so different.
Cool. Because I didn't really find so much about anything before she immigrated. And even really her early years before she moved to the pig farm. Oh. I will definitely take a listen.
I just want to tell you, it's the Pisces in me. But
it definitely is.
For everyone who's listening, who's like, no, stop. But
very cool. Stephanie, remember when we first started the podcast and we were clueless about where to start?
I'm pretty sure we're all clueless, Natalia, but lucky for you, I knew the perfect place to start, Anchor.
We are lucky that we found Anchor, and even more lucky that we found each other. But our listeners don't need luck now that they know if they want to start their own podcast, Anchor is the way to go.
Anchor is everything you need to have a podcast. With both a desktop and mobile app, we can record, edit, and launch all of our content within one program. Natalia and I think of Anchor as our daddy.
Daddy Anchor gives us one easy place where we can build all the episodes and it automatically launches to all the best listening platforms like Spotify and Apple. It's my favorite kind of relationship. Anchor gives me everything I want and it's free.
When you're ready to start a podcast, Anchor is going to make it easy. And then you will all realize how two armchair detectives like us managed to pull this off. Available on the App Store, Google Store, basically anywhere where you do a Google search, you can find it right there.
So yeah, do you want to share your story for today?
I do. I have such an amazing story. I'm going to give the warnings now. If you're a parent and you have nightmares, today I'm going to absolutely scare the piss out of you. So if you don't want that, just go.
We'll see you next week.
Bye. All right. We speak frequently about criminals who are given multiple chances and how that leads to them committing more horrific crimes.
Yes.
However, in certain states, there have been laws passed in an attempt to stop repeat offenders. And we'll go into the controversy that surrounds it. There is what is known as the three-strike rule in places like California and New Jersey. Here's how Cornell Law School defines the rule. A defendant who is convicted of a felony and has previously been convicted of two or more serious or violent felonies must receive an indeterminate term of life imprisonment. Three strikes laws aim to reduce violent crime and address individuals whose conduct have not been deterred by more conventional approaches to punishment. While currently 23 states uphold the three-strike rule, this wasn't the case 20 years ago. As is usually the case here in America, it takes something really horrific before we decide to put safeguards in place. I'm going to tell you that story today. On the night of October 1st, 1993, there was a girls' slumber party in Petaluma, California. The mom hosting the sleepover, Eve Nickel, was sleeping in a room right down the hall as three 12-year-olds, including her daughter, Polly Klass, played board games into the evening. Eve had divorced Polly's father, Mark Klass, 9 years earlier, and Polly's little half-sister, 6-year-old Annie, was sleeping peacefully with her mom. As the seventh graders played the board game, something truly out of a horror movie happened. Around 10:30 p.m., a man came into the bedroom holding a knife he had grabbed from the kitchen. He told the girls he wasn't there to hurt them. He only wanted money. "Don't worry," he told them. "I'm not going to touch you. Everything is going to be okay." He tied them up and put pillowcases over their heads. Polly said to him, "My mom and sister are in the next room. Please don't hurt them." He told the girls to count to 1,000, that he was taking Polly with him, but he would free her later. When they were sure he was gone, her friend Kate ran and woke up Polly's mom, Eve, who called 911. Within 30 minutes, an APB was broadcast, however, only on one channel for Sonoma County. 20 miles away, in a rural area north of Petaluma, a babysitter noticed on her way home that there was a suspicious car in a ditch on the private property of her employer. When she reached a gas station, she called the police, who sent two deputies to investigate. And here is where everything went sideways, 90s style. The cops get to the car and run the plates, but nothing comes up because, of course, 90s style, nothing of the databases are connected that would tell them what they need to know about the car.
Oh my God.
I know. The next problem is they didn't know about the APB because since they were in another county, they operated on a different channel.
I'm already frustrated.
When they questioned the driver of the car, they noticed that he's literally dripping with sweat and he has leaves in his hair and dirt on his clothes. The deputies asked him what he's doing at midnight on the side of the road. And the man said he had gone on a drive to sightsee and his car wouldn't start back up.
At night?
In the middle of the night.
Oh my God.
On private property. Got lost. He explains he was dirty because he had gone under the car to try and fix it. The deputies got some seriously bad vibes, so much so that they tried to convince the property owner to do a citizen's arrest for trespassing. In California, this is how a citizen's arrest works, according to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department website. You have the right to arrest another person for a criminal act they commit in your presence. Unless absolutely necessary, you should avoid taking direct action and call us to avoid being injured or sued for false arrest. In some specific situations, limitations in the laws may make it necessary for a deputy sheriff to have you make a citizen's arrest. In this case, you must sign a private person's arrest form, but the deputy will physically take the person into custody and ensure they are properly arraigned in court. You may be required to testify in court. So I guess the deputies didn't have the authority to arrest the man themselves. I don't know why. I think that's bonkers.
Yeah.
The property owner refused to do the citizen's arrest. So all the deputies could do was search the car, which turned up nothing. Then they call a tow truck to take the car away and turn the man loose after filing out a field report. If those databases had been connected, would it have made a difference? We want to think so. We want to believe that the APB would have made a difference too. Later, the argument would be made that the greatest difference would have come down to one thing. This man should never have been out among us to begin with. Because that man, a career criminal named Richard Allen Davis, was already a twice convicted kidnapper who was out on parole. Davis, a Gemini born in 1954, is part Native American from his maternal grandmother. I only mention this because they did eventually have to go onto a reservation to arrest him. Both of his parents were abusive alcoholics, and he had a miserable childhood. When his parents split up and he was 9 years old, they made him choose who he wanted to live with. He chose his father, who was very mentally ill on top of everything else. His father was schizophrenic and hallucinated. He would frequently beat him to the point of throwing him through walls, and he once broke Richard's jaw.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's not good. At 10 years old, he started stealing things, and by 12 years old, he was being arrested for burglary. At 17, a judge told him he could go back to juvie or he could go into the army. He went into the army and was generally discharged 13 months later after being written up for using morphine, fighting, and going AWOL at times. Then, at 19, Davis was at a party for an 18-year-old girl who was found dead later that night from a gunshot wound to the head. The police ruled it a suicide, even though all her friends and family said that she was absolutely not suicidal. And there were a very strange 7 suicide notes lying around.
Wow.
Yeah. A year later, he was arrested repeatedly for a string of burglaries. During this time, he told psychiatrists that he heard this dead girl's voice in his head, as well as other women's voices telling him to rob and rape them. And still, he was out of jail on parole after another year. When he was 22, he attempted to abduct a 26-year-old legal secretary from a train station. She managed to get away and by pure luck flagged down a passing car that happened to belong to a highway patrolman who arrested Davis. While in custody, Davis hung himself up with bedsheets, and as a result, he was transferred to a mental hospital. He later admitted that this was his plan all along, because from the hospital, he escaped.
Seriously? Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. During a 4-day crime spree, he beat a nurse to within an inch of her death with a fire poker. Stole a shotgun from an animal shelter and tried to kidnap a female bartender. The bartender got away and managed to grab her own gun from her car. She shot at Davis until he ran away. He was arrested again, and this time Davis is sentenced to 10 years in a max security prison, which, if you ask me, 10 years is still extremely light for a man who has now twice tried to kidnap a woman and who has almost beaten someone to death.
Yeah, he's just on a rampage. Like, this is not
always.
It's just insane. But yes, go on. I need to know more.
He was paroled after only 6 years. At this time, 28-year-old Richard Allen Davis gets himself a girlfriend and accomplice, Sue Edwards. Together, they assault a woman with a pistol, beating her until she withdraws $6,000 from her bank account. Then, they go on to rob a yogurt shop, 2 banks, a restaurant, and a Value Giant store.
Jesus.
Talk about going on a tear, right?
Yeah.
The pair of them were only caught because a cop pulled them over for a busted taillight.
Oh, those taillights, or trunk lights, too. They'll get you.
Get you every time. And of course, Davis turns on his girl, Sue, tries to pin it all on her. He goes back to jail, though, all the way until he was paroled in June of 1993, only 4 months before he kidnaps Polly Klass. So here we are again, with this man being turned loose by the deputies because they can't find anything to pin on him on the side of the road at night. But even if they had pulled up his record at that time, so what? He had gotten away with all of this over and over, and he was still let back out to hurt people again. Would the deputies have been able to do a thing? Even if they had, it was already too late. We'll never know, because that son of a bitch refused to ever even give a solid timeline.
Oh my God.
We'll go back to that.
Ugh.
We'll go back to the story first.
Okay.
About 2 weeks later, Davis gets arrested for drunk driving and again is let go.
How many chances does this guy have?
I'm going to say this. And it's why I mentioned it at the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, some people are going to come for me. I think that perhaps his nationality and where he lived on the reservation perhaps gave authorities a reason to hesitate in bringing him in.
I do know sometimes, like, on reservations, they want to handle their own problems. Like, they have their own police, their own hospitals, doctors, schools. I get that. But also, like, this isn't like jaywalking. This is serious. You know what I mean? Like,
yes. But also, I think, you know, the local police pull you over for drunk driving. None of the databases are linked. It's not going to pull up to all your other serious shit.
Yeah.
So they see you drunk. It doesn't pull up to any of your other things. You're near or on the reservation. You look Native American or your address is from the reservation. And they don't want things to get messy. It's the politics. And so they're liable to let you go with a warning. Right? Or with a ticket or whatever. Yeah. Well, so he gets let go, but this is important for later. So just let's keep that tucked away, that drunk driving citation. Okay.
Okay.
Because he does get cited for it. Okay.
Okay.
So it's not the kind of thing where it's like, oh, keep on trucking. He's in trouble for it. Okay.
Okay.
He just doesn't get, brought in. But he's got to come back to court later. Meanwhile, Polly's friends helped give enough of a description for the police to make a very good sketch matching Davis and missing posters featuring both Polly and this sketch of the man who took her. They go up everywhere. But a month goes by and no one has seen Polly. The investigation is starting to go cold. Palm prints were found in her bedroom. But again, a non-centralized system meant that nothing is connected. Her parents held on to hope that whoever had Polly would return her. Winona Ryder, a native of Petaluma, offered $200,000 for Polly's safe return. This case was national news. It was everywhere.
Wow.
Then, the owner of the property where Davis had gotten his car stuck finds some items on her property on November 28th, and she calls the police back. They find ballet leggings that are sent to the crime lab for testing. The tights belong to Polly, of course, but they still can't find Polly. Except something finally gives on November 30th. Since Davis didn't appear in court after his DUI, a warrant had been issued for his arrest.
Oh, good.
When Davis was finally brought in, police recognized him immediately as their guy. At this point, they take his palm prints and match them to the ones taken from Polly's room. The pieces start to come together. On December 3rd, 1993, the biggest search at that point in California history was launched to look for Polly. More than 24 agencies came together, numbering more than 500 people, to search for Polly Klass. Even today, it's considered one of the largest missing person searches. But by December 4th, when the search was to continue, Richard Allen Davis had broken down and confessed to the abduction and murder of Polly Klass and told authorities that he would take them to where he had buried the body. Roughly 30 miles from where the search had been taking place, off of Highway 101, Davis had buried Polly Klass in a shallow grave. He has never told police exactly what happened, but it is generally agreed that after kidnapping Polly, Davis strangled her right before those deputies came to check on his car in that ditch. He tossed her body from the car while the deputies were nosing around, then came back later on and took her body to the gravesite that he had dug up earlier on Highway 101. During the trial, Davis tortured the family. He never showed remorse and purposefully provoked outrage by taunting Polly's family in the courtroom. In 1996, the trial concluded with Richard Allen Davis being found guilty of first-degree murder of kidnapping, robbery, burglary, and committing lewd acts upon a child. During his sentencing, Davis smiled. When asked if he had anything to say for himself, he said that Polly's last words were to tell him that she had been molested by her dad. At this point, the courtroom erupted. Mark Klass jumped up and lunged at Davis. He had to be restrained by officers while her grandmother burst into tears, and Davis flipped off the cameras and the courtroom with both middle fingers.
I wish you could see my face right now. My jaw literally dropped.
I have pictures. We're putting all of this on Insta. The judge, Thomas Hastings, told him, "It is very easy for me to pronounce this sentence given your revolting behavior in this courtroom."
Good.
And then he sentenced Davis to death by lethal injection. Today, Davis is in solitary confinement at San Quentin Prison.
He's still on death row 27 years later?
Yes, and that is because California since then has gone back and forth on whether they implement or do not implement the death penalty. So sometimes the law says, yes, we're going, and sometimes the law flips and says, no, we're not doing it anymore. And so depending on which years it's on, which years it's off, it's like suspended, not suspended.
Oh my God.
Because people sit on death row for so long to begin with, it's like he's just been sitting there perpetually.
What a win of
everything.
Everything.
Yes. And I mean, he's had to be in solitary confinement because he tried to overdose at one point. And then he had so many attacks on his life. So they just, I mean, he's had to be in solitary.
Has he been diagnosed as like multiple personalities or schizophrenic?
I'm not saying antisocial, schizoid personality, antisocial. So mentally ill, definitely mentally ill.
And not everyone who has schizophrenia or some of those like personality or mental issues is a killer.
Go
not
on.
Saying that
no.
at all. It just
no,
is.
No, no.
He
it's just yes. He
got
does,
away.
He
with
does have those.
Oh,
yes. And I mean, he told these things to psychiatrists when he was in custody, when he was much younger, and was not treated appropriately. Was not kept in these mental hospitals where he should have been in criminal units, kept locked up when he told people, oh, I hear women's voices telling me to rape them. Well, then I guess you guys should have kept him locked up and medicated.
Yeah, he's a danger to himself because he tries to commit suicide all the time. He's a danger to society.
He's a drug addict anyway because he was abusing drugs since he was in the army. He's tried to overdose multiple times, an alcoholic, and he's violent. So he cannot be on his own. He cannot be among the people. I mean, they knew this.
I can't believe he made it all the way into the army.
I can't believe, first of all, he was only generally discharged. How you start fights, go AWOL and abuse drugs and are not dishonorably discharged is beyond me. But I mean, just from there and within his first few years committing crimes, he should never have made it out of there.
I wonder, like, did the system fail him at first or did the system fail everyone else?
So we're going to go into that.
Okay.
We're going to go into it because there's some aftermath here.
Okay.
So in the aftermath of Polly's death, Mark Class founded Class Kids, and her mother started the Poly Class Foundation, both organizations that give support to the families of missing children and advocate for laws they believe help protect the public. Polly's father lobbied politicians to bring about California's three-strike rule. And in 1993, it was only the seventh state to have such a law enacted, and only the second state after almost 20 years to make this a mandate. So now let's dive into the problematic three strikes rule. When I was doing my research, practically every podcast that has covered this case focused on how the three strike rule would have saved Polly. And I don't want to get this confused. I do think it would have saved her. And at first, I was 100% behind this law. I mean, it embodies everything that I think is appropriate. If someone continues to go out into the world and be violent, then they absolutely should not be allowed back into society. Mm-hmm. That seemed to me like the whole purpose of justice. However, the three-strike rule for me is like the death penalty. When it's used perfectly, correctly, it's justice. And you could call me barbaric and probably also a violent person deep inside. But I think it is a damn effective and appropriate way to punish the worst people in this world. The problem with the law is that we know it isn't used correctly, not even half the time. And so we have...
Sure. Yeah, that's right.
We have another example of a corrupt system that manipulated our fear as a means to their ends. Most states require that one of the three offenses to be violent. So we're talking murder, kidnapping, sexual abuse, rape, aggravated robbery. Yet some states don't require the offenses to be violent. So the charges can include things like simple robbery, arson, or even drug possession.
Having an eighth of marijuana.
California is one of those states.
Ugh. That's why there's people on death row who are like, got in trouble when they were 19 for weed. And now it's legal.
So an example of how this law can be twisted to pervert justice was seen in 2009. When a man was given a 50-year sentence after he stole $153 worth of videos from a Kmart.
Does Kmart even exist anymore?
I think some places maybe.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. A study by the Justice Policy Institute in 2003 found that 2/3 of the criminals sentenced under the three strikes rule were sentenced for non-violent offenses. And it became very apparent during that study that this law was being used specifically by California, Florida, and Georgia to basically sweep the streets of minorities to fill the jails.
And that's why we have overcrowding.
Yeah. So in 2022, 45% of the criminals jailed in California under the three strikes rule were Black, even though they make up less than 7% of the population in California. I'm going to tell you something else, because this one will just knock your socks off.
Okay.
In 2003, Maryland, so that's a three strike state, Maryland had incarcerated about 300 people under the three strike rule. Florida, which is one of the top three problem states, right? Florida had incarcerated 1,600.
Oh my God.
Okay. Georgia had incarcerated 7,000.
7,000?
Okay, so we have Georgia, 7,000. Florida, 1,600. The next closest one was Maryland, right? With 300. So see the disparity. I want you to take a guess what California came in at number one. Georgia was 7,000.
Oh, God.
Guess what California was at? Just guess.
10,000?
42,000.
Why?
That is six times the state behind it. And basically 42,000 times what every other state does.
That's over 110 people a day.
At that same time, New Jersey only had 10 people sentenced under the same law.
There's 10. I mean, there's some stuff going on in California, but not 115 things a day.
And that is nonviolent offenders.
That I'm shocked. Like, I knew California was big. And I knew they had the three strike. I know, like, you feel like you know, but you don't know, you know?
So this is what was happening to me. Like, when I first started this story, I was like, yes, three strikes. Let's get these people off the streets. We can't, you know what I mean? Like, these criminals, we can't let them out. This is to keep us safe. Like, if this was my kid, like, how could they let this happen? And yes, like, if they are murderers, if they are rapists, if they are like busting into like places with guns, aggravated assault, aggravated burglary, like,
if they're violent
offenders.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Like, if this law was working the way it should, yes. However, it's not being used that way. And it blew, when I read 42,000, I was like, what? Like, what? How? Like, I understand if it was 42,000 and every other state was like 10,000, 20,000, 5,000. But this is like, what? Like, every other state had like, some states only had like 5, 10, 20. And like, okay, Maryland was like 300. Some states had like 150. Like, but 42,000. Georgia didn't even come close at 7,000.
I mean, devil's advocate. California is obviously a bigger state. They have bigger cities than I would say Maryland. Texas. But Alaska.
In Texas, you would think Texas would be like, let's put everybody in jail.
Yeah.
No.
Justification for this.
Some states have a two-strike rule.
I did not know that.
Yeah, some states, but those states are very strict about it being like absolute violent, like murder, done. Like, that's it. You're done. And I get that. I get that too.
Yeah.
But listen, I don't think if you kill people, you should not be out on the streets, right? I'm all for that. But this is insanity.
I mean, I have heard stories like in California of like people, they were running with the wrong crowds when they were like 16, 17, 18, but they got sentenced with that three strikes because of like drugs. They weren't even doing the drugs. They were just, you know, either dealing or just wrong place, wrong time. And I really think it is a race issue too.
Yes. I mean, it's being used that way. Being used that way. It was glaring. It was I didn't even throw half the statistics. I only picked like the juiciest statistics, but it's like those pages went on and on. Like, I could just keep throwing them at you, but it was exhaustive. I was like, my sources, they are the longest list of sources I've ever had to list for a research. It's like a page and a half. I've read through so much.
I have a question. Mm. Since Ron is obviously your attorney, what does he think of the three strike, two strike? Do you know? Or
he hates it. Yes. Yeah. So here's the thing. He says it's used all the time as a tool. And unfortunately, it gets used as a tool in a way that you wouldn't think. What happens It gets used as a bargaining tool to pressure clients into taking plea bargains. And so it doesn't work how we want it to work anyway.
Oh.
Because the other side, prosecutions, just use it. And then criminals take plea bargains and end up not doing time that we want them to do anyway.
Wow.
It's not being used the way it should be used. Also,
no.
None of the studies show that states that use the three strike rules have declines in crime, in violent crime, compared to states that don't employ the three strike rule.
Yeah, the numbers, those statistics, it's just...
They don't lie.
No, numbers don't lie.
I wanted them to. I really wanted them to. I'm not going to front because I can admit when I'm wrong. It's my one redeeming trait. I wanted to open those reports and see that it made a difference because I want to believe that if I just punish somebody enough, they'll stop. But it doesn't work.
No,
what's happening is that criminals are actually thinking that, well, if I'm going to jail anyway, and this is terrible, if I'm going to jail anyway, by the time I get caught, then it doesn't matter.
Well, it does.
Well, I know it does. Yeah. Like a normal person thinks it does.
Right.
However, it's not reducing crime.
Ugh.
And what's happening is it's hard on street crime. It's not reducing white collar crime. It's not actually reducing violent crime. It's just hard on, because it's being used like this in states against like people who are like with drug possession and simple robbery. It's just being used against minorities who are dealing drugs and like breaking into stores and houses. And not that those are crimes that we shouldn't punish criminals for, but they're just using it so they can fill up jails and line their pockets. Also, when this law was being pushed, do you know who one of the biggest backers of it was? It's not going to sound good. The NRA.
Really?
That's, yeah. And I don't like that.
Huh.
I don't like that. I learned something today.
That's for sure. That's for damn sure.
Mm-hmm. And now all of the podcasts that covered Polyclass, and there was a lot of big ones, not a single one mentioned this little nugget. Annie, Polly's little sister, along with her sister, Jessie, started their own podcast.
Oh, that's cool.
It's called A New Legacy. They are fighting against that three-strike law.
Really?
Yes. So they actually grew up and were very unhappy with how their sister's death was used as a tool for this pro-incarceration movement.
Yeah.
And they're fighting against it and using their experience as victims to advocate for restorative justice and community resources that can prevent crime before it even starts. The sisters believe that helping people with their mental health and financial struggles would support public safety in a much more effective way than punitive punishment. In an interview, Annie said, "These agendas tend to exploit people's fears and make people imagine really terrible things. But arguably, the worst thing that could ever happen to a family happened to us. And if we can imagine a better future, then I think that's something everyone can imagine." Mm-hmm. And so that she was saying, if we can get into the communities and provide supports that enable these communities to get better help for their trauma, mental health support, financial support to keep people from being on the streets, you know, committing crimes in the first place. And when they are getting caught for like these low-level crimes, we can, you know, help them actually turn their lives around instead of just throwing them into jail and not, you know, actually reforming them. You know what I mean?
Giving them more problems.
Right. Instead of actually putting them in this jacked up system where we keep throwing them back into jail for money and overpacking our jails and this privatization of jails that's happening. Like, if we stop letting that wheel run us, then we can actually change the system. And then we can prevent crime before it starts. And we can keep these abused children from growing up into the monsters that they are. She said, you know, I still hate the person that killed my sister.
Sure.
I don't forgive him. She said, I'm not there. She said, but I also understand that those people were children that were once abused and that they had struggles that maybe if somebody had stepped in and stopped, maybe they wouldn't have grown up to do the terrible things they did.
What amazing women. Jesus.
I know.
Because it's one thing. I mean, I totally understand not forgiving and you can't forget because how could you? You can't ask that of them. But they're the bigger people and they are saying there's a problem here and we need to fix it. It reminds me there. I don't know where they're doing it, but because of the number of calls that the police had been getting, they're actually mental health calls and the police are being taken away from like actual things that they need to be assisting in, like a shootout or whatever, that they have started. There's like one, they're starting with one, then they're going to increase it to five, but like units where if dispatch can tell that it's a mental health situation or someone's in crisis due to, you know, X, Y, and Z, it's not something that the police need to be called out for. They're sending out like a social worker or someone who can help with that medical need.
Yes.
Because what are the police? I mean, the police get sent out and they're like, well, what do you want me to do about it? I'm not a mental health professional.
Right. Oh, my God. Perfect scenario. I was just listening to something like this. So there was a call put in to the police. There was a domestic and the wife called in. It's a couple that argues all the time. Right. Sometimes it gets a little physical. However, this time the wife was calling and I mean, it sounds like both parties are a little bit, you know, mentally unstable. And the wife was screaming that, you know, the husband's coughing on me and he's trying to get me sick on purpose. And the cops were like, what do we do here? And they ended up calling a judge and saying, you know, what do we do? Do we go out here and file a report? Do we arrest the husband? She says it's abuse. Like, is this abuse? Like, what do you consider this? Is he harming her? What if he actually has COVID? Like, what do you consider this? Where do you draw the line? And like a call like that, you shouldn't dispatch police officers. That's a misallocation of resources.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm saying? You should not send people out with guns. That is a scenario that is could escalate because those people have hit each other before. Like, but that is a situation where you need de-escalation. You need a social worker, a mental health expert to go out there and calm these people the fuck down, to talk them down, separate them, cool people off. And then if you need help, you can call for backup, but that is absolutely a situation where you need mental health help. You need, I mean, somebody to step in and say, whoa, what's going on here? Talk these people down, separate them for the night if you have, like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
don't send cops out there. That's not going
to
help.
I mean, it's one of the reasons why Josh doesn't want to ever, because he has experience with EMT paramedic, and he is licensed in those fields. He gets sent out on all of those calls. And I'll ask him, I'm like, oh, how was your call or whatever? And he'll be like, it was just medical. Or like, he'll just like throw it aside because what is Josh going to do? Poor guy.
Right?
It's just someone who's off their meds, unfortunately.
Or they're just worked up. Yeah. You know, people just get emotional and it's overwhelming. The situations, you know, it becomes very heated and somebody needs to step in. But who? You need this middle, this middle team. You need somebody, a mediator.
The fire department can't go to every medical call.
No, and neither can the EMTs, and the cops shouldn't. It really has to be another number that people can call. Not a 911, but like a something else.
912. You know?
Something, you know? So, you know, at the end of it all, I had to take a step back and say, okay, here's this idea, and I wish it would work, but it's kind of like giving insulin to a diabetic. In a better scenario, I should help patients before they get to that point, before they become diabetic. Because of course there's no money in that for companies. As same as there's no money in that for the justice system. If they keep people out of jail, how will they make money? Right?
Yeah, it's how you think about it. I mean, you could be like, hey, you, if you are type 2 or you're at the cusp of it, you need to do this and this and this and send them to all the programs for whatever you need. Yeah, nutrition.
To change the diet, to exercise more and to do all these things that can help prevent that or to keep you going longer before you get to that point. You know, instead of waiting till somebody's already in crisis and then stepping in, that's what they're talking about, is putting these services in place, help reduce that percentage before they're in jail, before you're stepping in and putting in that 3-strike. And still we should be stepping into places like California and saying, no, you should not be implementing that for nonviolent offenders. That is bullshit.
So
they need to.
I just thought of something. Because the California has that 3-strike and they're putting away 115 people a day. That's if they've already had 3 strikes. So what's 3 times 115?
So it's 2. They have to have 2, at least 2. So they can have just 2. So like that guy who got put away for 50 years, his 3rd strike was stealing those videos from the Kmart. He had 2 prior robberies that were also like low level robberies from stores. They also were nonviolent offenses.
That's just crazy. So it just, I mean, there can't be that much going on in California, which just tells me that this law is being abused or this rule is being abused.
It is. It is, but nobody's stopping it because they keep telling people it's for your own good. Every time people are up for re-election, they run on this platform and they tell people it's for your own safety. And they'll actually put up pictures of violent offenders like Davis. And at the time that they were proposing this law, and even for years afterwards, they would flash pictures of these serial killers and say, you know, we're keeping guys like this off the streets. You know, this whole tough on crime. And okay, people are good, afraid.
Do it properly.
We are afraid. Right. Because the problem is it's not just them you're keeping in prison. The problem is you should flash pictures of the next 41,000 Black and Hispanic men you've swept off the streets for a baggie full of drugs. Show pictures of them. Tell us who else you put in there.
Or people just wrong place, wrong time, and they just arrest everyone.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of people who have done bad things and they need to be punished. However, you have to be fair. There has to be some kind of real justice in the system. And this is not justice.
No.
This is the perversion of justice. I was surprised. I learned a lot. I think what her sisters are doing is amazing. I mean, I put links for everything. They'll be in the show notes. It was something that I did not come across easily. It was after a lot of digging around and a lot of links. But it's there. It's the other side. The darkness on the other end of it gives a little perspective. This is not the last time you're going to hear of Mark Class or Polly Class, because it was going to tie into my next story.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. All yeah. Right. We will see him again.
Okay.
I'll talk to you later. Bye.
All right. Bye.